I think listening is the most underrated superpower for salespeople. And people always joke bartenders are like half pouring alcohol, half therapist. And there's a lot of crossover. It's just asking questions, listening, taking it all in, and figuring people out is a major part.
Today, Curtis McKella in the house. It has been 8 years this month when Curtis departed the halls of Memory Blue. Since then, he chased his now wife out to LA. He's back from LA, and he's the only alum that I know who has a corporate showroom in downtown DC, one block from the White House.
Hi, I'm Mark Gagne.
And I'm Chris Corcoran, and you're listening to Tech Sales is for Hustlers. Tech Sales for Hustlers is a podcast where we catch up with Memory Blue alums and reminisce about their start in high-tech sales with us.
Let's go get some, Corcoran.
Gagne, you know I'm ready.
Curtis, welcome.
Thank you, guys. It's been too long since we've caught up. Without having the first Fridays, I haven't been able to see you guys, so it's good to chat.
Well, we've had the first Fridays. You've just moved to Southern California.
Well, I guess since I've been back, I've been quarantined.
There you go. Well, it's good seeing you. I can't believe it's been so long. It seems like just yesterday.
I know. Closing in on a decade.
All right. Well, Curtis, let's do this. I'm excited about this. What we want to do is we want to get the audience, get to know you a little bit, right? The distinguished audience. And the best way to do that is for you to kind of give a fairly brief summary about where'd you grow up, what were you like as a kid, where'd you go to high school, where'd you go to college, and then we'll kind of start at college. But just give us a little bit of background.
Yeah. So I grew up in Rockville, Maryland. So always in the DMV, went to Rockville High School. And then after that, Salisbury. During college, I lived in Ocean City every summer. So it's definitely a very formative time. After college, graduated, I think I spent maybe 9 months working as a server at Gordon Biersch. And then in August, I think 2012, came to Memory Blue. And
let's talk about it for a sec. What were you like as a kid? So it gives a little bit of high school personality. What'd you do?
You know, I was always a bit quiet and laid back. And I still am pretty laid back. I've opened up a little bit more and talk, but pretty similar overall to my demeanor and personality now.
It's good.
Very SoCal.
Yes. I fit in there when I was out in LA.
Nice. All right. And what'd you major in Salisbury?
Political science. So doing absolutely nothing with that. Originally, I thought I was going to go to law school, but after 4 years, I was like, I think I'm done with school. Let's get started. And I don't regret it at all. One of my real good friends was a year older than me. And when I was kind of on the fence about going, he was miserable in his first year of law school and just said, hey, man, if you're not like sure and passionate, don't do it because it's hard and you're going to hate it. And I was like, I think he's right.
That was good advice.
So you parlayed your political science degree into the server job at Gordon Biersch.
Yes. Well, I worked as early as high school, started as a busboy, and then have done everything in a restaurant from bar back to bartend, waited. So it was an easy transition, always a good way to make money. And I think it's where I formed some of my sales skills in front of people.
Talk more about that. Like what skills you got as a server, bartender, what did you learn that you took to and applied to a career in professional sales?
I would say listening. I think listening is the most underrated superpower for salespeople. And people always joke bartenders are like half pouring alcohol, half therapist. And there's a lot of crossover. It's just asking questions, listening, taking it all in, and figuring people out is a major part.
All right. So you were at Gordon Biersch doing your thing. How did you find out about us?
So I found out about Memory Blue through a guy named Chris Scheich, who still runs in the tech world. He was a neighbor of my parents.
Mr. Scheich.
Yes.
He doesn't run in the tech world. He gallops.
That is a fact. I mean, the guy sells data storage to the Census Bureau. So like, it's just the ultimate cake. That's the way to do it. So yeah, he was my parents' neighbor, moved into a great neighborhood when he was in his mid 30s. And I was like, what is this guy doing? He's killing it. So got to know him pretty well playing golf. And he just said, hey, man, like tech sales is a great life, great way to make money. It's fun. It's challenging. Why don't you check out this company called Memory Blue? They help people get started. So reach out to you guys and went through the process with Tiana, with you guys. Yeah. Woo! Is she still around?
She's like a stay-at-home mom down in Florida.
Yeah. I think she had just moved to Florida when I went through the process.
She was with us for a while. She's a baller.
Yeah. So then came to you guys and rough, hadn't figured it out, and you molded me into what I am today.
That's not true. So, all right. So what do you remember from when you started? So TKO talked you into it. I remember interviewing you because like, oh, this guy, this is interesting.
So my main memory of, and I don't remember it. I've been trying to think about it all week, like leading up to this, but I think it was, I interviewed with Chris first and I thought it went well, walked away, and then did the phone interview or the role play with maybe Mark, or I don't know if it was vice versa or what it was.
No, that was it.
And then I came back to meet with Chris. I was like, all right, you know, the phone role play went pretty well. And Chris was like, man, I got to tell you, when we first met, I thought it was terrible. I wasn't that impressed. Honestly, it was a no for me. And then Mark said it was one of the best role plays we've ever had. So, I mean, I guess we got to give you a chance. And I was like, all right, this is off to a good start.
Okay. That sounds about right, actually.
Yeah. He's not beating around the bush. I appreciate that.
There are some things that I definitely remember. And we'll talk about that in a second. All right. So you started Memory Blue. And what was that like from what you remember? Who was on board? Like, yeah.
Yeah, we were in the old office that was like split between downstairs and upstairs, I think.
Yeah.
And then we were only there for a couple months. I think I started on my own as a one person hire, but I was a week after Matt Bright, Brittany, and maybe Breslin or those guys.
Fish Daddy and Breslin. Oh,
wow. Yeah.
That's a good group.
It was all like right at the end there or end of the summer. So we got started. During that time, Thad was like pretty influential in the office. He was doing a lot of the training, jerry-rigging a lot of the technology and call recording and all that kind of stuff. So it certainly had like a startup vibe to it. None of the fancy like outreach or sales loft that people have today. It was, I remember we would press the space bar on some random program and it would start recording.
Yeah. That's totally right. Thank God for Thaddeus Walsh.
My first account, and I don't remember the name of it, but it was some type of banking software where we would cold call banks and it was like a back end thing. And their whole premise was, all right, banks are using Excel sheets. This is this great new software that is going to work. And in my mind, 2 weeks into the job, and I'm just like, this is the dumbest software like I've ever heard of. Nobody cares about this. Everyone we called, I think the quota was 2 for the entire month. And I didn't know better at the time, but I just remember my gut was like, if the quota is 2, like that's pretty low for an entire month. Like something's up here. Like this is too hard. And they eventually dropped after a month and a half. I don't think the company made it very long.
That's what happens.
So
at some point we rolled you out on Cigital.
So Cigital was after that, actually.
Okay.
Next was Fortinet.
Fortinet.
Yeah, it was me and Matt Bright were the first two guys on Fortinet, and Nimit was our like our DM, our manager, and it was his first account as well. And one of the memories I always look back and laugh on is it was our first week on the account, and so me and Matt were Nimit's first two like people that were reporting to him. And I don't know if he was just having a bad day, but like I walked over and asked him for advice. And he just kind of like leaned back in his chair and put his arms over his head and was like, man, I'm going to be honest with you. This is my first week too. Like, I have no idea. Just go back there and figure it out. I don't know what to tell you. And I was like, all right, well, so we got the blind leading the blind. This is going to be good.
That's like something out of a sitcom. Yeah. I mean, literally, that's like a sitcom. The way you describe it, by himself. This guy, Thaddeus Wallace, was Jerry Reagan, influential in the office because he's the only guy who could make the IT work.
Yeah.
You press some random ass spacebar to record things, but you had some crazy client that went out of business.
Yep.
But, I mean, Fortinet, that's a good little lineup right there. I'll take that in a 3-game series. Bright and Curtis with Nimit working on Fortinet.
Yeah, so we kicked it off and it went really well because I remember Chris Hendy was like the guy who was managing it and he was our age, basically. He was like 3 months older than us, but he was like handling us. And I'm pretty sure Joe Sakura, who was the VP, was like, dude, I don't have time for this like lead generation company. Can you deal with this? And then we just throwed out and Chris was awesome. I actually met him in person when I went to work for Cigital. We went out to one of the trade shows out west and like partied with Fortinet one night. This was after I was off the account, but a bunch of great guys.
Nice. One big hot tub. Hey, knowing what you know now, and we'll get to Cigital, what would you have told yourself if you go back in time the night before you started at Memory Blue?
So I think focus on systems, just the discipline to do stuff every day. At least when I was at Mary Blue, everyone was so focused on just like getting out. The light at the end of the tunnel is, and not that you want to leave Memory Blue, but the pie in the sky is, all right, you're going to get hired out by your client. You're going to make more money. You're going to be earning, like living this high lifestyle. And really, most of the time your client hires you out, you make 8 to 10 grand more, which isn't that significant. But I would go back and tell myself, don't race to get out and get hired out. Focus on your craft. Get really good at it. Make as many calls as you can, because that's going to have a longer impact than whether you get hired out and 6 months or 7 months. Focus on making yourself better.
Oh man, that's gold. We could end right now, Curtis, because to this day, and Chris and I love our STRs, but to this day, that's some of the challenge. And we love the clients, but sometimes it doesn't make sense to go work for the client, even if the client wants to hire you. But it's hard to resist the siren, like the temptation of going to work for the client when you may not be ready.
Well, and the other thing, so I'm 31 now. Mm-hmm. And when I started with you guys, I think I was like 22 or 23. Because you come from your childhood to college, depending on the person, maybe anywhere from 3 to 5 years, maybe 6%. So that's like the majority of your life, but you don't really realize people should be thinking in decades rather than thinking like month to month. So if you can kind of have that approach of don't be in such a rush, things will take care of themselves. But you don't know that because you're just like, I remember for me, I was just like, how can I become the VP of sales of a tech company by the time I'm 25? I'm like, all right, how can I become Chris Shike? And you don't realize, you're like, actually, that takes 10 to 15 years. You're not going to do that. You're not going to start in August and then be like running a tech company by December. It's just not possible.
What you said reminded me, Tony Robbins, he has a saying. It says, most people overestimate what they can do in a year, but underestimate what they can do in a decade.
Yeah. I'm a big Tony fan. Love Tony. But it's so true. Don't get so caught up in that race and just focus on yourself, making yourself better, listening to what you guys have to say. Because, doing it for close to 20 years now, I'm sure the formula is pretty good. But it's hard to tell someone that when they just start.
Well, the truth be told, when Mark and I started our careers in high-tech sales back in the 90s, what we wanted to do is we wanted to prove ourselves, number one, but we wanted to get promoted as quickly as possible.
It was almost pre-internet. Almost.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was doing. I was selling the internet.
It was.
But we were impatient too. Like, we wanted to get promoted as quickly as we possibly could. So it's not something that's just on the young folks of today. That was Mark and me when we started our careers.
It's weird because you're recruiting people who are impatient, because we want people who are patient, because a part of the trade of being a good sales professional is we don't want super patient people. But then you bring these impatient people in and you're like, hey, be patient. Now that you're here, be patient and work it out and do this incredibly difficult job. Right? Calling these folks and emailing these folks who you're interrupting their day, and do this for a little while. And it's probably the hardest thing a lot of people have done by the time when they start working that role.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, Memory Blue, I don't know about hardest, if hardest is the right word, but it's the most tedious. Sounds negative. It's not tedious, but to be great, you got to like love the process and love the system and have that discipline to make 100 calls. And when you're not making calls, prospect, build your list, get ready for the next day. You don't know that when you get hired. You're just like, sales, sweet. Like, I'm going to have an expense account. I'm going to take people to Nationals games. Then we're going to hit happy hour and I'm going to close some deals. Like, this is it.
Yep. That's not it.
Being an SDR is the opposite of that.
All right. So then at some point, you were only with us for 7 months. So at some point, we'll get to Sigil, but we talked about Sigil too. But when you were there, so you were making these calls, doing these things, what did you get good at? What was like the Curtis signature move or trait you developed?
Well, similar to me as a kid, it's being silent, like learning to shut up, ask a question, and then wait for the answer. So many new people and experienced people, salespeople in general, they'll stack questions. They'll ask a question and then follow it up with something else and tweak it so they can get the answer they want to, but you don't know what the client wants. So just, I think that's always been something I've excelled at, is just like asking a question and then listen. And that comes from listening to your call recordings. It's really the only way to do it.
So I love that, like how you're naturally like a quiet person and you're using that as such a strength, because there's a lot of salespeople that talk way too much.
Yeah, I actually think it's like a misperception. It's like a lot of the best salespeople I've worked with over the years, they're not like Tony Robbins, for example. It's not like somebody up there, razzle dazzle, like all these smooth lines. It's just people that listen and people that work and they follow up. They do the ugly parts.
Is that teachable?
Yes.
That's good, because some people think, oh, well, how do I learn that?
Yeah, I think so. Jumping ahead, like later on, I had some roles where I would hire, train, manage people, and for sure is teachable. And it's through listening to those calls, and all you need is the light bulb to go off in someone's head. So just like getting them to understand that it's for sure teachable.
Nice. We'll get into that when you talk people. All right. So when you're at Memory Blue, who was like the best person that you worked with besides yourself, of course?
So when I started, Brandon Taylor was like the man. He was the big fish in the pond. But I remember people were like, listen to his stuff. He's awesome. The one guy, and he actually started after me, that I was always super impressed with. And I think it's because it's like, a lot of his strengths were my weaknesses, was Justin Brown.
Oh, and Jay Brown.
He was such like a bulldog and would work hard and make a lot of calls and just hustle and not take no for an answer. And those were the things like I struggled with. I wasn't going to come in and crush 250 calls. It just wasn't. And I didn't wake up wanting to do that. And I always felt like he did. I was always super impressed with him. And I think we've kept in touch kind of, but he seems like he's gone on to do great things. So,
all right. Yeah. Both of those guys were super strong. It'd be nice if we could get Brandon Taylor to come on the podcast at some point if he's listening. And then Jay Brown is amazing. So those are good people to emulate their game when you're early in. All right. So you got rolled out on the Sigital.
Yeah, so went to Sigital, and like a couple months in, Taylor Pierce had just gotten hired out by them.
Taylor.
They had Troiani.
Troiani Myers.
Troiani. Yeah,
he was working there, and that like fit everything I was looking for. It was a cybersecurity company. Like they had an interesting sell because it was application security. It wasn't really a product. It was more of a process, like a service they offered. So it was something that was appealing to me. And yeah, went started going out there a couple of days a week. And I think I fit in well with the culture of Taylor and Troy and Stuart Joss, who was the VP there, and worked there for a couple months. And then they hired me out. And I remember everyone, you try to get out of the office. And then Memory Blue has such a good like energy. And it's fun. You guys have been very intentional about like the culture you build. So there's like, everyone's young, people like get along. And I remember like my first day when I went out to sit, I had already been there, but went out there full time. They just throw us in a back room and there's no windows. And that company, sales are like the second class citizens, because all the security guys, the VP of security, the guy who started the company, was like a big shot in the world. I remember he would just walk around, and I quickly realized it was like, grass is greener. I realized, I was like, maybe Memory Blue seems pretty fun right now. No one likes us here. We're just like doing all this work in the basement. And where's the glamour? Like, where's the expense account and the champagne? So I was there. It was going really well. So started doing SDR work, and then also like closing some small deals. They had a certain threshold where they would just let us close them on the inside. And so I think I was there like 6 months or so, because I left in January, February, somewhere around there. And then everything was going well there. Outside of life, I go to play golf. I golf a lot, grew up playing, and belonged to a country club growing up, and then joined when I was out of college on my own. And for whatever reason, this is like 10 o'clock in the morning. We're about to tee off, and there's no like cart girl. There's no halfway house. So they're like, hey, if you want drinks, get it now, because once you're out on the course, you're not going to be able to have it. And it was Saturday. I was having fun. So I was like, all right, I'm going to go get a drink. So I go in there, 10 o'clock in the morning. Order a Long Island iced tea. It's pretty aggressive. For
Long Island at 10 a.m.? Yeah.
Yeah. And this guy, like a couple bar seats down, is sitting there by himself. He just starts laughing. He's like, nice order, man. I'm actually drinking the same thing.
What?
Game recognizes game.
Yeah. We start talking, and it turns out he's the VP of sales for Iron Bow. Of course, just as like fate would have it. So we talk for a little bit, exchange information. And then he was like, we're not hiring right now. But, you know, I tell him what I do. He's like, we're not hiring right now, but let's keep in touch. He's like, shoot me an email. Maybe something will open up. So I follow up with him. A couple months goes by. He hits me up and is, hey, man, like I'm looking for a junior person to do an outside role. Are you interested? Then I went there.
Just all like right. That. And so why did you go? Was it because you wanted to go from the inside to the outside? What inspired you to make that move?
Go to the outside, take another step. So I was still doing basically lead generation at Sigital, and it was more money. It was a path to the outside, path to close my own deals. And it was also a cool role because like they would start me off without a quota. So I was like shadowing people, but then also closing some deals so I could make some money. And I actually made like pretty good money, enjoyed it. Obviously, the VP of sales, we had similar drinking habits. So like he had built a great culture in the sales team and did that for a while and loved it.
So what were you doing for Iron Bow?
So for Iron Bow, they're a reseller. Predominantly, like their biggest relationships are Cisco and EMC. So a lot of data storage and hardware, like routers, endpoints, stuff in the office.
Like networking and storage, it sounds like.
Yeah. A lot of like video conferencing before Zoom took over the world. A lot of like high-end web conferencing, conference rooms, stuff like that. So did that for about a year while like learning the ropes, but then also great like entry to the outside role.
Was it federal, commercial, or a blend?
Commercial. So that was actually another example of us being second-class citizens in this company. So the commercial team there was like the redheaded stepchild. So their federal business does hundreds of millions. And it's because they have a really strong relationship with the VA. And it's a huge business revenue. They were trying to build out the commercial team. So that's where we came in. It was great.
So talk a little bit about differences between two things. One is selling a product like your EMC Cisco products versus a service, what you were selling, the application security consulting. The differences between selling a product and a service, number one. And number two, I'm curious to also get your perspective on selling for a manufacturer or the service provider as opposed to a reseller. If you could talk a little bit about the pros and cons of both.
So selling a product can oftentimes be a little more transactional. Typically, like there's a hole that you're trying to fill and this thing will do it. So when it's actual hardware, typically someone builds an office and they need certain things. So it's a little more cut and dry about the needs. Whereas selling a service, sometimes you have to create that want and that desire. People, a lot of times you're selling something people don't know they need yet. And so you have to like create that need and create that want. Now, on any given service, there's going to be different roles or different people that you're selling to. So it varies. I find services can be a little more challenging, which I enjoy. But then you have software as a service, which is a blend of obviously a product in it. So there's ways where it meshes.
The second part of the question was what it's like working for the manufacturer or the service provider versus working for a value-added reseller.
Yeah. So at Iron Bow, I was the value-added reseller. And what I'm doing now, I'm working for the manufacturer. I love what I'm doing now. So the equivalent would be in that scenario if I was Cisco or EMC, because you're selling to salespeople a lot of the time. So they have their clients and their end users, and they come to you with an opportunity. So you're brought in to close the deal, which can be fun because you're not doing a lot of the grueling part or the ugly side of sales. But selling to salespeople is fun because a lot of times they'll listen, they'll challenge you, they'll push back more, and it forces you to get better. It's a different process. Selling to salespeople, a lot of times it turns into a little bit of an account management role because once you have that relationship, they're going to come to you with more opportunities. So continuing to service them. So instead of just selling that product, and then a lot of times in the software world, you'll have a customer service team passing it off to them. You continue to manage those relationships.
So what was it like working for the reseller and the person who had to do all the quote unquote ugly part of sales?
Yeah, I mean, it's more similar to what people do at Memory Blue. So it's the early part of the sales process. It's going out, hunting, finding the opportunities, creating the need, creating the desire. And it depends on the company you're at. Someone like Iron Bow, a lot of times people know the name because it's in the top right-hand corner. Every time you watch a Capitals game, it's a recognized name. Whereas if you go to a different company, people are like, you're from who? You're selling what? So it depends, really.
And talk a little bit about, so if you're working for a reseller, and so you were reselling Cisco and EMC, there's a lot of other resellers that represent Cisco and EMC. So what would you do to try to differentiate yourself from all the other resellers that essentially was telling the customer or the prospect the same thing you were?
Bring them more opportunities. That's really, if you can be the best at that, because they get leads as well. Cisco is a $1 billion company, so they can bring stuff to you as well. And it's staying in touch with them, creating instead of a client salesperson relationship, once you approach it as like a partnership. So I would reach out to the Cisco guys and we'd cold call together. There was a lot of more seasoned people. So I mentioned I was like for Iron Bow, I was the junior person in the role. So I guess I was 23 or 24 at the time, whereas my counterparts were in their 40s, 20 years into their career. And they had a different process where I would hit people up and say, hey, let's meet on Monday morning or Friday morning or something like that. And let's crush some cold calls. And they would be hesitant. They're like, yeah, I mean, sure, I guess no one's ever done that before. So then I show up, and lots of times they'll just sit there. I would make the cold calls, but we do it on speakerphone. So I'd say, hey, I'm sitting here with Sean from Cisco or Mike from Cisco. And like, then we'd go through it. So activity, being in their face as much as possible, that's really how you get them to want to work with you. And then also for a company like that, they have some of that expense account. So there's a little bit of the champagne and that type of stuff.
So what would the reps say, the manufacturer reps, when you would show up and bring your own headset and phone and say, watch this, and you start breaking glass?
They'd eat it up because it's different. So people would, speechless isn't the right word, but they would just sit back and watch and be like, oh shit, like this guy just set a meeting for me. Awesome. So I think they're appreciative. Again, it's coming back to that partnership relationship.
It's the hustle.
Yeah.
That's a scarce commodity.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's cold calling, creating opportunities. No matter what your sales job is, there's never a time where it's not valuable. And I think some of the best companies, it's when, so, you know, I mentioned Sigil, for example, where like the sales people were the second class citizens. It's when a company approaches it that says, all right, everyone's in sales. The CEO's in sales, the CFO's in sales. No matter what you do, if you're the engineer, you're in sales, like you're the face of the company. Like we're all in this together. Let's create those opportunities. That's when great companies happen.
Where have you seen that?
So one of the companies I work for out in LA, Snack Nation, actually did a great job of that, of having an intentional culture. And that's where everyone, they talked about it all the time, that you're all in sales. Actually, Mark Cuban is pretty open about that. I think he wrote like an ebook about sales, and that was his whole thing. It's the number one skill anyone can learn, no matter what their job is.
Yeah, and I agree. So you were at Iron Bow, and then I want to hear about moving West Coast and Snack Nation and the culture and all those things, because you were early on there. So you were at Iron Bow, and then share with us what happened from there and how you went from the East to West Coast.
Yes. So when I started with you guys, my goal, I was like, when I'm 25, I want to make 100 grand. Like that is the goal. I'll be sitting pretty. That's how I'll define success for myself. So I'm at Iron Bow. I'm like flirting around that number in that age. Life's going good. I remember sitting having dinner with my mom one time, and she's a teacher. She's like, this isn't normal to be making this much money this young. Appreciate it. It's not always going to be like that. And then a couple months later, I reconnect with a college girlfriend who had since moved out to LA to chase a career in entertainment. So she came back for the weekend. And it was one of those unhealthy relationships everyone has when they're in their 20s, where like you get drunk and you text someone. And we had broken up because I was 2 years older than her. So I graduated and she was going to study abroad. So that's why we broke up, even though we weren't necessarily, we still liked each other, but we were like, hey, we're going to be on the other side of the world. Let's not do this. But then life took us in different directions. She comes back in September. We get drunk in Baltimore, end up together. And we're both just sort of like a Thursday night turned into a weekend together. And we're like, hey, still think about you all the time. Like either we need to move in together and get married or never speak to each other ever again. There's no middle part. And I was like, all right, well, like I have this great job in DC, making a lot of money. All of our friends are here. All of our family's here. And she's, well, I'm chasing my dream out in LA and there's palm trees and 80 degrees everywhere. You can do sales anywhere. And I was like, actually, that's not a bad idea. So like I said, we reconnected in September. And then by the time I got to LA, West Hollywood is where we were living, on Thanksgiving. And so 2 months, my parents were like, I'm sorry, you're doing what? To live with who? Pretty much everyone I talked to was like, this is the dumbest thing you're doing. It's a terrible decision. Like, it's not going to work out. I'll see you in a couple months when you move back.
What are friends for?
So yeah, get to LA. And in my mind, I was like, you know what? I can't just show up like without a job, being a deadbeat. But it was only like 45 to 60 days between deciding I was going to move and getting there. So not a lot of time to like go through the hiring process. So one of my buddies, my college buddies, was like a national training manager for Town Park. It's a valet company. And so he's like, all right, I can get you a job as a valet out in Hollywood, really famous hotel right on Hollywood Boulevard. I was like, sure. You know, how bad it could be. So I go out there, start doing it, and then it's awful. Once you go from working in the business world where you're very respected, you know, you got your white collar on and people take you seriously, to just some like asshole in a Lamborghini flipping you his keys and talking down to you. You're like, huh? So I go from making close to $100,000 to $10 an hour. I'm like, man, what was this a good decision? So that really lasted about 3 weeks. Then I was like, I have to get a job. So then that's when I applied and got the first job. Really, I went after, but it's because I went back to an SDR role at a company called Cornerstone On Demand, HR software, talent management. And it was appealing because it's named like one of the best places to work in LA, one of the best places in America. And they have the candy dispensers. People bring their dogs to the office. It's what you would see, very Google-esque. So I go back to the cold calling, very similar job to Memory Blue. And I was like, man, this is brutal. What did I do? Again, I have a first-time manager who is not as nice as a person as Nimit was. She was the type of boss who would, we'd have to have a meeting about the meeting I just had so I could fill her in on the meeting, or I would have to send her an email about the meeting I just had. And I was like, this is a little too hands-on for me. So start looking for other jobs pretty quick. And that's when I see actually a TED talk with the CEO of, at that time, a vending machine company called Human Healthy Vending. But this guy was just like inspirational. He's in his early 30s. The company's in Culver City. And I'm like, man, well, that's the type of guy like you want to be in his ship. I was like, I don't know what they're doing, but like my gut's telling me to trust this guy. I moved out here, already took a pretty big risk. What's another big risk? And then so I go to work for them. And like shortly after, the company pivots and becomes Snack Nation. And it turned out to be a great decision. I spent the next 2 years there.
The pain of finding and hiring strong sales professionals is a critical challenge that is widespread and getting worse. The Memory Blue Direct Hire Service specializes in filling sales development roles within the high-tech space. And with a one-year performance guarantee and 0% interest financing, you can feel secure in your selection process when you use Memory Blue Direct Hire. As a company, we hire close to 300 SDRs annually across our 5 office locations. That's nearly an SDR per day all year long. Finding, hiring, and developing sales talent is the core strength of our business. Now we're letting the public tap into the resources of our world-class talent team, specifically trained to find high-potential SDRs in order to close this gap. For more information on this service, check out memoryblue.com/direct.
So talk to the listeners about what Snack Nation does.
So Snack Nation, they've actually pivoted again as a company, but they sold snacking as a service. So a lot of companies, I remember, at least when I worked there, you guys did coffee and I think like beer on Fridays, but do you guys have snacks or anything like that in the office?
Bagels on Thursdays. Bagels,
that's right. I remember bagels. So a lot of companies will stock like Nutri-Grain bars or things like that. And typically when you're doing that, the office manager or receptionist or somebody in HR will have to go out to Costco and stock it up. And no one became a job to become a professional grocery shopper. So we saw this loophole, a market opportunity where we would call people up and just say, hey, for $150, $250, or $300 a month, we'll mail you guys snacks. So it's snacking as a service. And they built out the business model, and it was around the same time we were right down the street from Dollar Shave Club. And so over the last 5 years, those like the monthly subscription things are just, they're hot. So that it took off from there. And I got hired, and there was 5 of us the same day. So we were like employees 13 through 17 with, I think we had closed one deal. So basically $0 in revenue. And when I left, we had around 125 people and close to 20 million ARR. So,
wow. How'd you find out about the opportunity? How'd you get plugged in there? Like you saw a TED talk. How do you go from seeing a TED talk to being employee number 13, 14, 15, or 16 or 17 at a pre-revenue company? Like how did that all happen?
So the TED talk was on like healthy eating, healthy lifestyles, because in LA, like the stereotypes about LA are real. Everyone's like drinking green juice and worried about their chakras and like their chi being centered. Like the stereotypes exist for a reason. So everyone's very conscious of that. I don't remember exactly how I sent it, but or like how I came across the video, but I Googled a company and see that they're in Culver City, which is like, you know, the equivalent to Arlington to Tyson's Corner. So see the company's hiring salespeople. And at the time I had that job with the terrible boss. And I was like, I'll do anything to get out of here. It was back to a closing role as well. So I was like, oh, let's do it.
Do you apply and then the rest is history?
Yeah, I reached out to the recruiter And I think anytime, normally recruiters are recruiting people. So I think anytime someone, all the things I just told you, I included in my message, hey, saw a TED Talk with Sean. Seems like you guys have a great mission. Would love to be a part of this. So went through the interview process, which they have pretty similar to you guys, multi-step process, like pretty rigorous. And it was, yeah, got the job.
Curtis, you had at this point, you had a great, your experiences were cool. Going back to the AR, SDR job at a great company, or what was supposed to be a great company, that you were at Sigital, then us. When you were rolling into Snack Nation, how concerned were you too about the manager? Because, you know, there's this thing, should I work for a great manager? Or should I work for a great company? Do I want both? What's more important? And for you, listen to you talk about your career journey. I was curious as to when you're rolling into Snack Nation, you're like, okay, this leader is great, but you probably didn't work directly for him. I like the company. What advice would you have for someone? And what was your approach? Because you turned into a boss there too. You were training people. Talk to me about that.
It's tricky. I would lean short term. I think it's better to have a good manager at a bad company, because bad manager at a good company can ruin your experience. But the problem with that is in an interview, you see everyone's best side. So you don't necessarily know. And that's what's actually really unique about what Memory Blue does. And I hope the listeners and the people working there take this to heart. Working with your client, you get, as an SDR at Memory Blue, you get a chance to basically date the manager before marrying them. It's a unique opportunity to learn about the company. So I would lean manager. However, being at a great company, things can change. And especially at a startup, no one moves in a straight line career-wise. So your manager can quickly not become your manager. So it's a little bit of both, unfortunately. But to the listeners and everyone there, I would say if you have a bad manager and you have the opportunity to avoid the job, avoid it for sure.
Love it. Good stuff. So I get on LinkedIn. I look at what you're doing. You're doing a bunch of stuff. Like Snack Nation, what were you doing?
Yeah, a little bit of everything over the years. So like I said, when I started, I was doing sales and was fortunate. It was an overlap of great company and great manager. So Kevin Dorsey, who Mark, I know you've met.
KD.
Yes, because you, I think, sent me some messages. You guys met at one of the conferences. So we started and we were like selling, and then said at a startup, no one goes in a straight line. So we quickly realized like pipeline building and lead generation is the lifeblood of a sales organization. It really is. So they quickly were like, all the people that are doing really well are also really good at creating opportunities, setting meetings for themselves. So we were like, we need an SDR team. And we didn't have the money to go out and hire a manager. And Kevin, who is great at what he does, but he was focused on closing roles. So they came to me and were like, hey, you were at that company, Memory Blue. Would you be willing to focus on the SDR side and start like training people, start going through like practicing process and really focusing on that side of it? And I was just like, sure, why not? And that's probably the main thing I learned from there is just say yes to stuff. Either say yes for stuff, or if there's something that you think you want to do, either just do it or definitely don't ask for it. Just start doing it. And if it doesn't work, you can apologize later. But if there's a job you want and someone's not already doing it, just start doing it.
That's great. I got to give a shout out to KD because I was trying to track him down for years and he eventually hired us to do some work with him at Patient Pop. And I would always bring you up. That was my icebreaker all the time. So I know Curtis does good work. And if I get Curtis to get me an in with this guy, so Curtis, I owe you a cocktail for that. I'll buy you a Long Island iced tea when I see you next. Because it was good to work with KD.
When I was at Snack Nation, we were in between like rounds of funding. And I remember we looked at the growth projections and we're like, man, we need 10 more SDRs for what we're going to hit, for these numbers we're going to hit, because that's where it was coming from. So I was like, hey, let's hit up that company, Memory Blue. Like maybe we can do what they're doing or get them to like come do that for us. The meeting did not go well. I think he was just having a bad day because like the time I talked to him, he was great. The time he went through the meeting, it wasn't great.
And so what was it like working at such a fast-paced, fast-growth company?
You really become like entrenched in it. It takes over your life. And that was a cool company. It was very similar to Memory Blue. I mean, the CEO was 34 and he was like one of the oldest guys at the company. So you have 80 people in their 20s with dogs in the office and like it's a fun environment. So you spend a lot of time there. They become your friends. But work-wise, I learned so much. And my number one suggestion to anybody is if you get the chance to work at like a true startup with between 10 and 20 people or like a company that's still figuring itself out, do it. Because there's just parts of the business that you don't even think about. You get hired to be a sales guy, you're focused on sales. But then on that type of stuff, then it's like, all right, we learn about the production side. We learn about the marketing side, the account management side. And you're just like trying to figure stuff out.
What about in terms of what you were selling? So you went to sell technology and then now you're selling snacks.
Oh yeah. I mean, my friends at home made fun of me so much. They were like, you're selling snacks now? Like what are you saying? And I remember my dad was just like, sweet. So you left Maryland at Iron Boat, making good money to go sell snacks with some girl I've never met before. Awesome. Glad to see you're making great life decisions.
What was it like in terms of selling something different? It's still a solution, right? You're still calling into these companies. You're doing business to business. You're identifying challenges. You're giving an innovative, you're very evangelical in the approach. It's not bits and bytes in technology. So talk a little bit about that.
So this is the great part. In tech sales, it's how are you going to get around the gatekeeper? What are you going to say to them to get past it, get to the actual decision maker? When you're selling snacks, generally the person who like goes to the grocery store is also the person who answers the phone. So that part of it was great. The conversation rate versus selling software is extremely different. If you make 100 calls, I mean, you could have 60 conversations in a day because wow. They wouldn't all be like super in depth, but you'd be like, oh, who handles managing the office or company culture or stuff like that? And generally the receptionist, oh, I handle that. So I buy the coffee, I buy the toiletries or whatever. So that part was really nice. But the sale itself is similar. You're still developing pain. You're still like creating gaps and filling gaps. You're asking questions that probe their interest. And similar to Memory Blue, like we had a script, we had a process. You had certain who, what, where, when, why, how. Like you want to ask all of those same questions. So the fundamentals and like the process of sales is the same.
Great. And so how long were you at Snack Nation?
I think around 2 years. Actually, I have my LinkedIn up. I don't know the exact dates.
It's about 2 years.
Yeah. 1 year, 11 months.
Yeah.
So yeah, left there because as I've learned so Kevin and I were close. He was the VP of sales. And in startups, there's companies as a whole, there's lots of times there's a belief that the skill set it takes to run a sales team to go from zero to 20 million is not the same skill set that it takes to go from 20 million to 50 million or 20 million to 100 million. Because at that point, you're approaching like an enterprise level, you're managing like a larger range of people. So the VC funds or the investors believe it's different. So they brought in someone else to run the sales team. At the time, it was like, quote unquote, with Kevin, but it turned out to be like people tell you what they think you want to hear kind of thing. So the culture quickly changed. And I was just like, all right, like I think I've run my course here. 2 years at a startup it's a long time, unless you're like the person running the company or it's your company. And so I wanted to go do something like similar, like same process. So yeah, ended up leaving because of that. And shortly after Kevin left, and then a lot of the like core people left, there was a little bit of an exodus where I would say like between both before and after I left, 10 to 15 people on the sales team all dipped out.
So where'd you go?
From there, I went to a company called PatSnap. So going back into the software world, and it was nice and it was refreshing because at that point, I think I either had gotten engaged or it was like we had been dating for a couple of years and I was like, all right, we're getting engaged. So that's when you feel like, all right, I'm a grown up now. Like I need to start. It's not about, because the trade-off of Snack Nation, I love working there, but you're not making much money. So then I was like, all right, where can I go get back in like an enterprise sales type environment? So PatSnap was a patent searching software, and it was a great kind of startup because the LA office was truly a startup. They had just within the first year, but they're a Sequoia backed company. And in their London headquarters, they had 100 people. So you have the culture and the atmosphere of a startup, but you know, you're not going to go out of business at any point because there's a machine over on the other side of the Atlantic making sure all this happens. So from there, I got back into more of a closing role, having those like higher level conversations. So at Snack Nation, you talk to people, you're like, well, do people like snacks? Do people like having a great culture? It's a quick transactional sale. Our sales cycle was anywhere from like 10 to 14 days. And then going back to enterprise, then you're in like a 3 to 6 month process. And it was a culture shock for me going to a different company, or going back to, I'll call it a grown-up company, where like people tuck in their shirts and send emails where they're like, hope you are well, and emails with that type of stuff. And yeah, ended up being there for maybe around a year, perhaps a little less, almost 2 years again. So around that time, we were planning our wedding. Kelly, now my wife, was working in the entertainment industry, just become burnt out on it. It's a grind of a business, probably worse than sales. And we were missing family, missing home, and decided to move back. And then that's like eventually why I left there and transitioned into my family business, which is what I'm doing now, selling office furniture.
Let's talk about that for a sec, because I remember when you interviewed, part of what appealed to me was, I remembered it when we talked, and we hadn't talked in a long time until yesterday. You know, I've been out LinkedIn messages every now and then, and I hear a bunch of through the grapevine. Tell us a little bit about your dad's business, because you brought it up in the interview, and I was like, oh, this guy's going to be good, because he's around someone who's got his own thing going from a young age. And funny enough, you go to LA, you get all these wonderful experiences in sales, some operations, growth, and now you're back in DC working in family business. Is that what I should call it?
Yeah. We have four people that work for us in like the DC, Maryland, and Virginia area. And I'm so glad that I didn't come work directly for him out of college.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
At the time, he was like, you don't want to do this, go do something else. My mom was mad at him. She was like, you have this great business, bring him in. But I'm glad I didn't, because like it forced me to learn on my own, like kind of become my own business person and like figure stuff out rather than just doing everything his way. So now when we work together, I see stuff he's doing and I'm like, why are you doing that? Or he'll see stuff, you should do this. And I'm like, well, actually, no. And here's why. So it forced me to like grow as a person. But yeah, so now the easiest way to think about what we do is we outsource a sales team to factories. So we work with 10 different factories, predominantly, actually, yeah, they're all in the United States or Canada. And for them, rather than hiring direct salespeople, we just sign a contract and say, all right, we're going to manage DC, Maryland, and Virginia for you, like to promote the brand, close business, manage existing customers, help with the actual execution of projects. It's has me back in the outside sales role, which I love, because as I've kind of learned, like the monotonous, like sitting down at a desk at 7:30 and cranking out however many calls, like just doesn't work for my personality. I think there are people who like excel at it. And I'd rather have something that's slightly different every day. Being able to interact with people face to face, it's perfect. It's been wonderful.
Of your body of work before work and coming back and getting into the family business, what do you think prepared you the most for it? Is there a role or is there an experience?
Yeah, so a little bit of everything. I mean, the work I did at Iron Bow, so now I'm just like flip-flopped. So before I was the reseller, now I'm the factory. So understanding that side of it, understanding like, all right, when I was the reseller, what did I want from a factory person? And then at Snack Nation, it was a lot of standing in front of people, educating people. That's really presenting on a face-to-face level. So took a little bit of everything. And then, you know, what I learned. So one of the things we're doing now, or I've been doing over the last 2 years, is like modernizing the business, bringing in like implementing Salesforce and like showing our people what Drift is and getting them, rather just like taking an Excel sheet full of phone numbers, like putting it on the cloud so we can all use it together and like just modernizing the business really.
You've had a great path. When you look back, and you hit on it earlier, but when you look back on your colleagues, either at Memory Blue, but also at these tech companies, you landed in a great place. And if you work hard and play your cards right, this is something you could do. And you and Kelly have little Curtises. You could turn this over to them one day, maybe. So, I mean, this is going to be great. When you look back on what you've done and what your peers are doing now, what are some of the mistakes? What are some of the things you think the people listening should avoid as they make these career decisions as they go?
The thing we mentioned earlier about like thinking, trying to come out on a macro level and thinking in decades rather than months, figuring out like what makes you happy, like as a personal level, just because you start at Memory Blue, that's your first job. You're not like signed up for 40 years of selling. There's plenty of things you can transition to. So for example, like I took online classes to become a Salesforce administrator. Like I never did it, but I learned the process. Like I took data analysis classes. You can go do things outside of that. So figuring out what makes you happy and then either creating a role that emphasizes those things or going out and finding a role that emphasizes those things. And I mean, I'm fortunate and grateful that I have the opportunity to do this business, but now I'm able to tweak what I do and tweak my day to the things I like to do as long as they're productive.
You talk about it and you refer to it. Sounds like you're listening to things and you're reading things. How are you going to keep your skills sharp now? No, because now you're working for yourself, right? And you and your father, and you've got these employees to be responsible for and your customers. So before you were always working for someone. Now you're working for yourself. So how are you going to keep your skills sharp? And what advice would you have to everyone else out there to keep their skills sharp and always keep growing?
That's my biggest challenge now. I don't use any kind of like call recording technology because I'm not having those types of like structured conversations as much anymore. So I read a lot. I listen to podcasts. I try to take things from like other worlds. I think it was, I don't remember where I learned the term, but I want to say it's Malcolm Gladwell or someone has this term of idea sex. So where you like take something from a completely different industry and implement it into your own life, just like trying stuff out, but also going to networking events because I do basically work on an island essentially. So I reach out to my competitors all the time and I'm just like, hey, let's grab coffee. I'll try to pick their brains, do it subtly. I reach out to my customers or like more experienced people in the industry and just like learning, always being a student and coming back to that original point, listening. You kind of have to create ways to get better.
All right. That's a good note to end it on, I think.
That's a walk-off right there.
Well, Curtis, thank you for joining us.
I have a quick question for you guys. I remember when I was there, the big thing was like hiring former athletes. I always found there was like a similar mindset and like commitment that made them good salespeople. Are you still doing that? Or what do you look for when you're hiring people?
So we definitely like athletes. We also love servers. We do love servers for the reasons that you expressed. Essentially, what we're looking for is someone who has a history of outpacing the pack in one or more areas of their life, whether that be academically, whether that be athletically, whether that be extracurricularly. We're looking for people who can grind. We're looking for people who can run into some adversity and not quit.
So the reason I ask, one of the things we stumbled into at Snack Nation, and it was part of it is because you're in LA. Everyone has a reel and like a headshot in LA. Drama kids and like people with experience acting and awesome. Singing, probably the most, I don't know about gifted, but just the best presenter I ever met was a guy named Sean Gentry. And I think he's like doing something at Outreach now. He was like an acting major in college, but he had a legit like 8 to 10 minute reel I watched one time of his. He was like a very good actor. And it transitioned so well because he was used to repeating the same words over and over again. He was used to speaking. He was so good at fluctuating his tone and going up or going down at the end of sentences. And I was like, wow, we stumbled into something. Let's go get a bunch of actors.
Plus, that world is very competitive. They're used to rejection. It's competitive. You need to be on. Somebody's always coming for your spot. Agreed.
And you're acting, you're playing a role. Your whole identity isn't wrapped up into it where you could just be, all right, I'm going to go play sales professional from the next 8 hours. And then I'm going to go live my life. And being able to detach your identity from your role is critically important.
So what I'm hearing is you want to move back out to LA and open up an office for Memory Blue after you sell the furniture business to your next of kin.
With everything I'm seeing online, your next office has to be in Miami, right?
Oh, yeah. Let's see.
That's where the exodus is going.
All the VC guys are going to Miami. The mayor, Francis Suarez, is a salesperson in himself. I don't know if any of the companies are going. We'll see. We'll wait 5 years. Cool.
All right.
Well, Curtis, thank you so much for the time. It was awesome catching up with you.
Yes. It was good chatting with you guys, too. Hopefully, we'll see each other in person sooner than later. And hit me up if you need some air purifiers. We got to keep those people happy and healthy.
You bet.
You got it, brother. All right, Curtis. Peace out, man.
For almost 2 decades, Memory Blue has helped high-tech firms tackle their sales development challenges and carve out bigger market share in their space. Building and executing a carefully designed multi-touch cadence that generates a flow of sales qualified leads is the hallmark of our business. Our flexible solutions and talented professionals produce real results that clients can bank on. The end goal of our outreach is scheduling a qualified meeting so you can provide a comprehensive discovery call and bring the sale to a close. This carefully crafted process produces new business opportunities that have converted into over $1 million in closed deals. Hundreds of high-tech companies have trusted Memory Blue to help them grow, penetrate new markets, and test the viability of a new product. If you're interested in learning more about Memory Blue's full sales development services, head to memoryblue.com/sales.
Thanks for listening to Tech Sales is for Hustlers. Please subscribe and leave a 5-star review after the beep.